problems. So, let's start with the tutorial sheet. First of all, our favorites, these little questions to just give you a warm-up. Can Smalltalk inheritance be used to model Java's inheritance? Well, the first part, I think, we would intuitively say just, yeah, of course, that's why we introduced the whole thing. Just a little bit, be a little bit careful with things like attribute accesses, because remember when we talked about all this function dispatching and multiple inheritance and all that, of course, there are something like this polymorphic calls and virtual method resolution and all that. And of course, that is something that is completely different to the way that attributes are accessed. Attributes are things that are resolved in a static way. They don't do any dynamic dispatching there. So there's nothing like virtual tables for accesses of attributes or something. It's just a compile time computed offset to the start of the memory representation, and that's all. There's no such thing as dispatching going on there. So if we define something like this the small talk inheritance operator, that's meant for doing the resolution of the methods only. You have a slide about what you have to do to extend that to attributes, but in general, what I want to talk here is about the way that you resolve the methods, anyways, because that is kind of the thing that mixins and traits both concentrate on. So be aware of that. It's for the methods. The focus is not on the attributes here. Okay. The trait-based programming language, what purpose serves a concrete class, abstract class, and a trait on its own? That is a little bit about how the concepts of modeling your data structures are in an environment where we have all these features. And it's a little bit different to the way that you would try to design your data structures in a purely class-based or class and interface-based system. That is something that you should keep in mind, that you would have to kind of change your way of thinking how to arrange and how to decompose and recompose your functionality. It's those things, classes, abstract classes, traits, and all that are now carrying a certain purpose. These abstract class things, generally these mappings are kind of modules, which at some point belong to each other. In the sense that they have some kind of connectivity with each other. There's links from one to each to the other. Within one of these classes, within all of these classes' definitions. So you would, for example, provide something like a basic data structure facilities in one of these mappings. And so that is kind of your basic module that you would use. Then there's I was talking about track course. Abstract classes are just kind of the general way of talking about these mappings, while these concrete classes are once again things that are concretely found in the concept of how to program these traits as the final products of what your design is going for. You would put your traits all together in order to form a concrete class.
What we haven't talked about so much in the lectures and on the slides is that the traits approach is only talking about mappings to functions. There's nothing about attributes in traits. That is on purpose, because you remember when we talked about this fine-grained control things, there was need for differentiating between these attributes. In the example, it was the equipment and the fuel tanks and all that. And that is a thing that is necessary as soon as you start to talk about attributes or some kind of containers for data. And the concept of traits is to not talk about these types of things at all. Instead, introduce abstract methods whenever you would want to access one of these containers, and bind them only in the final product, in your concrete class, to a concrete container, in the sense that that's the place where you introduce your attributes, so as that you have the complete control over whether you want to share or whether you want to to disambiguate between those things in the very end, when you actually know what you want from these things. And as far as you do the composition of the things, you leave it open, in the sense that you put abstract getters and setters in your trait system. So that is how the vision of programming traits-oriented was like in these papers. Of course, that's a lot of effort, a lot of work put in, but you have to pay for your flexibility with a certain effort in that sense. So, of course, in other languages where you use attributes during your composition, you, of course, can directly access all these things, but you have to pay for that with pre-made decisions in terms of sharing and or disambiguation of access to these things. So that is a certain trade-off that is in there, and traits are supposed to give you the complete control over whether you want to share or to disambiguate. Okay, a lot of talking on that one. Let's continue with number three. That's I think shorter. Let C be a class composed from mixins M and N. So there's two mixins around and a class C, and M and N both implement the same method F. Now we're presented with two possibilities. The first one is conflicting methods F from M and N lead to a compiler error and have to be resolved manually, or there is no compiler error, but one implementation of F from M or N, depending on how you arranged the mix-ins, is dominating the other in terms of overwriting. What would you say?
Think there is no compiler error, and the implementation which was mixed in first overrides the other, because mixins I think become a member function after they were mixed in.
Mm-hmm. Is this a very comment?
Actually, I think it depends on whether these methods are declared as virtual, and if they are declared as virtual, then they will override each other, and if they're not, I think it would result in a compiler error, but it's just a guess, and I'm not really sure about it.
Let's just establish that in this world of mixed ends, the general concept in over in inheritance would be that every one of these calls would be considered to be virtual. But of course, that's an important point. I never mentioned that here. But in this area of mixins, you would assume that you mean that every method call would have to be resolved. But that's an important point, and I never brought that up myself. But that's when you are that narrow focused on one thing, you don't think about these things. Apart from that, you mentioned that there's a certain sequence in which these mixins are applied to the parent or something, and that's exactly the thing that's happening for the mixins. There's an ordering and there's priority on one. It depends a little bit on what you call the first mix in, and it depends a little bit on your view on that thing. But if you the one that is wrapped around the others as the last one, so to say, that's why I'm maybe not so content with this first name, is the one that is asked first for resolving that name. So first, last is always such thing, but there's a priority on there, and that's why in there there's mentioned that one of the implementations overrides the other. So yeah, depending on your wording, whether the first or the last, let's not talk about that. We all know that there's an ordering on that, and one of them is clearly preferred. So there's no need for the compiler to actually warn you about something or anything, because there's an implicit ordering there anyway, and thus it. What was that? There's an implicit ordering anyway, and thus can be used to resolve a call to such a method. So now let's switch concepts and talk about M&N as traits instead of mixins. So that is kind of the alternative approach that we had. And the same setting, we have method F within M&N. Now the question is, when we do our composition to a final class, then if we have a method F in both of these components, do we get a compiler error, or is one of them overwriting the other? Because that is actually the key difference between these two concepts.
Yeah, I think that there is a compiler error because there is no ordering on which is the first mixed in or implemented straight.
So that is actually exactly the thing. You have conflicting methods here, because that is the key difference. The difference between those two approaches is in how you compose your basic blocks. You have this symmetric composition or the asymmetric composition. Asymmetric composition allows for overwriting. Symmetric composition allows for conflicts. And in our the asymmetric one is used for the mixins. The symmetric one is used for the traits. So, yeah. That is actually the difference between those two, and that's what this question was all about, or these two questions were all about. So, hope that this made things a little bit clearer to you, so we can concentrate on the next thing. Why is exclusion an important composition operator for traits? I think with the last question still in mind, you might be... it might be easy for you to solve that one. Yeah, if you
if it is necessary to resolve those conflicts.
Yeah, without that you can, well, you can, but you have to resort to this overwriting in the very end, but that's kind of clumsy. Still, if you think about kind of trait-oriented things like these virtual extension methods, then yeah, there you don't have anything like exclusion because of the Lisk of substitution principle that enforces you to have all these methods there all the time, and you, the only way to resolve these things is by presenting an overwritten version of that thing. Okay, so that's kind of the key thing, and I have not found that implemented in any other system than this Smalltalk dialect, which I don't want to present you with here because that offers a lot of other, it opens up a cask of a lot of other things to educate you about. So anyway, consider the following C++ code trying to simulate a mixin. So that is something pretty similar to the example that you have seen on the lecture slides, where we have talked about how you could do something similar to C++ to mixins in a C++ environment. And the key thing is, like it has been on the slides, that you introduce a template parameter for classes and introduce that class variable super, which you can then use to keep the parent of your class still as a, as to be determined at the point of where you create your class or bind your template parameter. Good, so that was the technique from C++, and you would then be able to, for example, provide a method M, and within there you could access your predecessor's method via super. So exactly this line with the super is now the one that is the center of attention here. The super reference in line 4 is resolved at compile time, it's resolved at runtime, or can't be resolved at all. Well, that of course depends a little bit on you knowing how template variables are actually treated in C++, of course, but I don't know whether... Is there C++ programmers here?
Yeah, a little bit, but...
A little bit, but not deeply?
Yeah, not that much.
Don't be afraid. Even I would say that I'm by far not a real expert of C++. It's quite a complicated language.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But what would you guess from your experiences?
Yeah, from my experiences with templates, I would say templates are resolved at compile time.
So, first one.
And yeah, this whole mixin simulation is just a template, so yeah.
Resolved at compile time. Yeah, the thing is, it's templates is a massive inlining process that is can be thought as a pre-processing phase to actual compilation. So when the whole thing is compiled, at least at the moment, it's with the current versions of C++ and templates, the type system doesn't really see these class or type variables as type variables themselves, but it only gets them presented in the already inlined version. So there's no type checking going on here on these variables and whether they actually have something like an M member, but on the inlined version of them where you can actually check whether those things like this call to M are actually possible. So yeah, it's resolved at compile time, whereas the approach that we have had for the mixin-centered programming style would offer a dynamic binding of super. That also means that in the kind of real mixin approach, you would be able to kind of dynamically add mixins to other classes during your ordinary sequence of instructions. So you could start with a class of some type, do something on that, and then prepend a mix into it and continue on, because it's a dynamic process. You can connect this super pointer to something during the flow of your program, whereas here you would create them in a static way. So it can't be something like that. So that is kind of the difference between those two approaches, and why it actually matters whether the super term here is a keyword and resolved in a dynamic way, or whether that is a static thing. So it has influences on how you can use the whole thing. So moving on. Those are now... same as the last one, by the way, things that have been taken from older exams. But I think especially this thing here stems from a time where we had a little bit of different formalities, and I think should ignore those things here and just focus on the trait addition and the inheritance operator, Smalltalk inheritance, and this nil thing is something similar to just empty brackets. So sorry about that. I should have removed the brackets here. So what is the value of C inherits from T1. So in order to answer that, we have to look into the details, I would say. So that what that means is this nil thing inheriting from T1 plus T2. And that one inheriting from T1, and on that we issue a query for A. So that is just inlining the definition of C. So the innermost thing that we can resolve is this T1 plus T2 in this, yeah, so that is T1 maps A to 1, T2 maps A to 2. If we do the trait addition on that, traits were the symmetric composition things. What does that mean for mappings that are actually mapping to different values? Remember, we had this kind of diamond things there, where we had all those values as incomparable to each other. And if we have to find and join on those, we need to find the least dominating thing with respect to the ordering function there. So if we have 1 and 2, we have to find a dominator that dominates both of them. 1 and 2 are incomparable, so we have to go one layer up. We'll find that this one is the join of 1 and 2. That's top or in conflict. So for the straight sum here, we get the mapping A maps to top or A is in conflict. Okay? Then we the next thing that is in focus is now doing the inheritance with empty brackets. In order to resolve that, we need to look up what the inheritance operator actually means. And that is now an asymmetric join with the child as the, or the left operand as the dominating one. But in our case, that's nothing. So the only thing that we get added is this super mapping, but for our purposes, we will be querying for A afterwards, so it's not so interesting for us. So that remains like that. And that is kind of the value for that part of the expression. Now we have to do another inheritance operator on T1. T1 is... T1 can be rewritten as A goes to 1. Okay. Now we have to look up what the inheritance operator actually is, and what it is it is just asymmetric join of left and right. A goes to top and A goes to 1, which is for each entry that there is in the left operand, we take the left operand's entry. So for A, we take this one. And all the other entries that we don't find on the left-hand side, we take from the right-hand side. There is none. So that is the actual result. A goes to top. So what we get is hope that was not too quick. If you are left behind at some point, now is the time to interfere and ask.
What I'm confused about is that that in the question it's talked about traits, and before there was the statement that traits are joined symmetrically.
That's with the trait sum here. And in the end, you would apply your traits to a class in order to ground them to something else. So there's also the asymmetric join in there. But for composing traits with each other, you would by design choose the asymmetric join. But you have to take care of what symbol is actually used in this thing. I should have removed that thing because in principle, you can if you just look at the operators themselves, it's just operators on mappings anyway. So, I think in the slides we introduced the asymmetric join for the traits with explicitly these T sets, which would talk about traits. So, in the kind of the type system correct notation, I would have to call T1 and T2 traits here, but it's just a renaming of the same things, still mappings that we're talking about. So it's like I would have introduced a type def something for an integer and still an integer. So yeah, the important thing is that you know how to treat the plus and the triangle thing and know how to resolve them to this least upper bound or the asymmetric thing about that. But we'll see other versions of that. Also, I must say that particularly this number 7 is a quite old assignment that we had in the early days. That's why the notation is probably still a little bit messed up, and a little bit of a newer version of this calculus thing is mentioned over here, and you see there's nothing like traits anymore in here, but instead it's just talking about in principle this is supposed to be mappings, so okay, I have to redesign this thing. It doesn't suffice to just copy from exercise from the exam sheets. But assume these things as being mappings. And the question is now, well, you have to know how to apply the calculus in order to answer the question here. And the question here would be whether performing the symmetric join or the asymmetric join for the mapping C1 and C2 actually makes any difference or not. And if it makes no difference, you put tick. If it makes a difference, you leave it open. So, by the way, because one of the feedbacks was having multiple choices as questions in tutorial sheets and exams is something that you dislike quite much. Kind of this question 8 is one of the newer multiple choice questions where you actually don't have this free text questions anymore, but something where you can compute, and it's just giving you kind of propositions of what could be results of your computation. So that is kind of the multiple choice questions that I find okay to present to you, because you can just compute and you don't have to interpret free text questions anymore. So I hope that's okay to have as things. Anyway, it's now all about calculating in our symmetric and asymmetric joints, and should probably do that. So C1 maps A to some address and C2 maps B to some address. Does it make a difference to perform symmetric join and asymmetric join, those two?
I don't think so, as they both implement other different methods, and there will always be, there is just for in the symmetric join that will take A from C1 and B from C2, and in the asymmetric join it will take the same, as there is only one method, or they are both different in C1 and C2.
So they don't overlap. So, in the symmetric join, what actually happens would be that you would run into these case distinctions where you would take the entry that dominates the other one in terms of this diamond thing, and if we have distinct keys, so to say, then the you would always run into the case where one of the mappings doesn't actually have an entry for that key, so automatically the value of the other one gets taken. So that is the case for the symmetric one, but that's it's just rephrasing what you're saying for the recording here. And in the what was the other one? The asymmetric one. Yeah, since they are distinct, it doesn't matter which one you ask before, because well, yeah, you just get your answer from one or the other. So it's actually not. What was that? Okay. So you actually get that there's no difference, so the equality is actually true. Next one. We have a similar situation. We have... Oh, no, it's not so similar. Only the values are similar. So we have values 1 and 2 out there, but they are for the same key. It's key A for both of them. And the C2 especially has 1 as the value for A. C1 now is computed by mixing C3's mapping to C2's mapping in order to resolve that, we need to know what mixing actually means. So, for those of you who thought that the formulas would be a little bit problematic, you could start now guessing what the mixing application on C3 and C2 actually does. So, maybe you wanted to just start making a proposal and we refine it to actually match the correct thing step by step. So first of all, we need to know what the what this does. No, it's your day today.
Yes. Well, and the mixing of C3 to C1 takes all members of C3 and adds them to C1, except if there is already the same key in C1, which is already in C3, then the key in C1 would be overwritten by the key in C3.
I think you're quite close. It's just that this is C2, not C1. In there. It might not be so readable. So C1, or you wanted to talk about the resulting thing with this.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So at first we add C3 and then we add C2.
I don't dare to say yes completely right now,
okay.
Because it's one of these first last properties that I would once again probably put it the other way. But there's priority going on here, definitely. And maybe let's work out a way of how to handle these kind of expressions when we are facing them. So, what the fuck? So, this one thing would kind of be the first thing to reflect about. So, mixin of C3, what does that actually mean? That creates a function that is applicable to a mapping, and what it does is it applies inheritance operation on that with C3 as the child. So this mix in C3 creates a function with one parameter. That's what the lambda x means. That's just a very short way of saying public signature, then function name, and having x declared as the first parameter in a very functional way. So it's very, very abbreviated, and I don't know whether you have had contact with lambda calculus so far. It's the mathematical equivalent to defining an inline function or a lambda in Java 8 names or closure or whatever you're used to that thing. So that is stemming from the lambda calculus, and that's the way that you would denote that in mathematical terms. So it's a very abbreviated version of you create an inline function with x as parameter. And was that new? No. New?
Well, the binding from that notation to actual lambda function.
Okay. Yeah, that's what the name comes from.
Oh, no.
Okay. Yeah, and you would bind C3 as a child in the operator of, in the operation of inheriting from your parameter. Okay, so that is the first thing, and that's maybe where your precedence came from that you talked about, because there's this, you said that the one element would be preferred to the other one,
mm-hmm.
and that's because the mixin actually creates such a thing, which is then mapping to this asymmetric join. Okay, that is just the red box. So this thing, and now let's continue with the next part, which would be the expression that is the green box. And that would work like, well, you would treat that as an entity and apply it to C2. And in mathematical way, you would work, it would work the same way as it would do in programming languages when you have such a lambda function and a parameter on which you want to apply that. That is the application of the function. Here. So what you do is this thing goes into the lambda function as the parameter. So that's working like, well, you wouldn't use it that way because it's not a definition of a function anymore, but just for shits and giggles, let's put it like that for a short amount of time, and that goes away immediately. So that's not correct lambda calculus to write it like that. But it's binding the x to C2, and thus, as it is bound now, we can remove the lambda. So we get C3 inherits from C2 from that. And that is now introducing... what does that actually mean? That means asymmetric join on C3 and C2. And there's also this thing with a super going on, which is also asymmetrically joined. And that is now our C1. Okay, so let's remove all that. And that. And now have a look at the actual statement that we have to evaluate. C1 symmetrically joined with C2 is the same as C1 symmetrically asymmetrically joined with C2. So that over here is C1, and C2 is like this. And yeah, let's join them symmetrically and asymmetrically in one point. C1 symmetrically joined with C2 will, yeah, maybe we should probably evaluate that one first. C3 asymmetrically joined with C2, both of them talk about the same key A, so we get a mapping with just A. And asymmetrically means the left hand side is preferred, so we map A to 2, and also there's a super reference added via this one here. That's I don't really care too much about how that turns out to be. So that is our C1. C2 doesn't carry any super things, so the super will just always be the same. Now, symmetrically joining this C1 with C2 creates C2 has 1 as its value for A. C1 has 2 as a value for A. What is the symmetric join of those?
Conflict.
Correct. If you do it in the asymmetric way, well, there won't be a conflict in that case. So, as both of them, C1 and C2, talk about the same thing, but different thing, but map to different values, one of them will have a conflict and one of them won't. That's all. So we leave that one unticked. Whew. Next one. There's once again a mixing definition here, but now we know how to treat them. So one by one, mixing C2 on C3 is just another way of writing C2 inherits from C3. That's what we have established last time. C2 and C3 talk about the same thing. Yeah. But now it's the other way around. Okay. So we will have C2. It's the mapping to 1 asymmetrically join the mapping to 2, and also there will be this super thing added, which we only get one super thing anyway in the whole thing, so I'll ignore that for now, but in principle, these things need to be carried out, and what we'll get from that is, the left one is preferred, the right one doesn't talk about anything else, so this kind of completely goes away. Then there's the super thing, which will lead to having a super mapping to some intermediate mapping that we don't know. Good, that is our new C1. Now, symmetric join with C2 will give us what does that give us? That gives us 1 here and 1 in the mapping. So the outcoming thing will be, well, we need to compute the least upper bound of 1 and 1. What's that?
1.
Yeah, so one dominates itself in that sense. So it's one of this, it's smaller or equal, which we are talking about, and if we talk about the same thing, it will remain the same thing. So that is still a mapping to one. And the other thing that we have to look out for is is the super thing, and as in C2 there is no super mapping. I think the join between the abstract and the or the undefined and the mapping that maps to something will stay the same. So that will be the same one as the one that has been before. So it's still the super goes to that one. Yeah, then as opposed to the other side of the equation, C1 does an asymmetric join with C2. Well, that will just ignore the entry of C2's A, because it is already defined in left-hand side, so that will evaluate to exactly the same thing here. Thus, well, I would say it's correct in that sense. A little bit wondering, I think, in here, there's some miracle not crossed. Yeah. Good. Next thing, another mix-in, C3, C4, which translates to C3, C4 as being in inheritance relation to each other. So that translates to C3 goes to inherits from C4, and C2 actually also has C3 inherits from C4. So C1 and C2 are actually the same. Good. Symmetrically joining the same and asymmetrically joining the same just doesn't make any difference. So, two. Good. I hope that helped a little bit with all the formalisms, especially if this second order expression things were something that was that were confusing you. So it comes from this second order logic, first order logic speak, where the one thing is just talking about constants, while the other thing talks about predicates on other things, which is kind of like functions. Yeah. Anyway, having fun with mix-ins. Well, fun is always relative, isn't it? It's just names that are now more concrete than just C1 and C2 and C3 and C4. It's now actual names that stem from some kind of application domain. This time it's the streams. And now it says we should construct a sync file stream which mixes classes sync RV into the class file stream. So what's actually demanded is to say the synced file stream is mixin of the sync RV to what is it? The file stream. Abbreviating here because writing on there is a pain and there's not so much space. But in principle, that is what we need to compute here. We have had that sort of computations in the last assignment a lot, so we should by now know how to perform that. And what we also know by that is that that is just another way of saying that SRW inherits from the file stream. So what does that mean on the if we replace the symbol with its definition? That means that we do asymmetric joins of the syncRV set and the file stream set, and also perform things like super goes to the file stream. I'm still abbreviating here. And the right-hand side is now an expression with asymmetric join of what is it? Is it it's syncRV and file stream, which means that if there are things in conflict, then if there are things talking about the same keys, we prefer the left-hand operator's versions, which is syncRV talking about read and write, same as the file stream. So we can just ignore the file stream and just take the syncRV versions of the, those things. So that's read mapping to 5 and write mapping to 6. And yeah, if we combine that with the super thing, we can just kind of remove all those things and put another comma in there and be done. And that's the outcome of the whole thing. R and V map to syncRV's versions, while super maps to the old mapping. I think since we had the other question right before that, that's not so difficult anymore to do. Okay. Does anyone? Is there any active Ruby programmers in here? No. it's not a modern thing anymore, is it? Or it's company hiring you for Ruby on Rails jobs or something like that anymore? Well, maybe the hype is over now.
They are more advertising for JavaScript.
JavaScript is now the new thing to do?
Yeah.
Oh, you poor things. Well, yeah. That's a very sadistic thing to do. Emacs. Well, anyway, we will have a prototype-oriented language next time, so that is quite similar to what the core engine of the JavaScript is actually doing. So we'll have the joy of programming in that way at some point. Well, question is now, do you want to see me writing Ruby code if you don't know Ruby anyway, or is it sufficient to just have a look at how that actually looks? By the way, that that thing is just about, that assignment is kind of a more of an informative assignment in the sense that I won't ask you ever to write Ruby code yourself. It's just about showing you how that language would model the lecture's problem, so to say. So I think if there's no Ruby programmer there, then it's probably sufficient to just have a look at the solution anyway and continue with this Java-esque things. And maybe, is there a Scala programmers in here? So at least the last tutorial might be something that you would be more interested than in Ruby. Okay, so let's prefer that approach then. Good, so let's have a look at no, isn't there? Oh, it's like that. So that is the solution to that thing. So first of all, there's this kind of modeling of the hierarchy that we had in the setting, where we have a kind of a base class stream that is kind of the mother of all the streams in there, and then there's specialized versions like the file stream and the socket stream. So in Ruby, you do class definitions with class and end, class stream, and end class stream, like that is the block for the stream, and you have definitions of methods with def, and define read here and write. Read doesn't have a parameter, write does. And for simplification purposes, to actually notice whether anything is happening or not, I've just did some print lines there, or put string calls over here with just informative things like reading or writing of the thing. So it's very, very abstract and very concise to just have some kind of basic functionality that we can inherit later on. Okay? Good. Then there's the file stream that inherits from stream, that works with this arrow that points the other way than it does in our drawings, but that's syntax. Then there's an attribute here that's just fname, which is initialized with the file name. So yeah, that's just Ruby syntax as an attribute, and it's initialized. And yeah, now we have new overwritten versions of read and write, where the new read obtains its data from super, and yeah, it puts out something new to notice you that was actually has actually been running, and then returns the data that it obtained from its super version. So it redirects your call to its predecessor and does own things here. So far, nothing too complicated. And same goes for write. We write via super call and then notify the user that we have been somehow called. It's kind of very abstract of what the file stream is all about. It's just wrapping things around other things. Now, SyncRV was the idea of that was to provide an actual mix-in, a module that we can attach to several parents with mechanism of inheriting. So you do that in Ruby with modules instead of classes. You have to specially mark them, and you can put methods like this acquire and release in there that are kind of acting like library functions and are callable from within the module. And that's what is actually done here in the write and read definitions. So we issue acquire log and release log, and in between we call super and the read does also acquire and release, and in between we call super, which then dispatches to read of its predecessor without us having to actually specify our predecessor. So it's not like in Java or C++ where you, well, let's not think about this templates thing, but if we would have just pure object-oriented methods, then you would have to specify as a compile time ancestor, parent, which is not here anymore. So that is kind of a thing that still needs to be bound. It's acting like one of these lambdas or modules that you can still apply to something else, and the domain on which to apply that thing is classes or other modules. But with that, you can apply that thing, which you could interpret as a function on classes, to other classes, and obtain new classes that are enhanced versions of the other ones. And for example, an application of that is can be seen here, where you have the class synced file stream here, which is inheriting from file stream and includes the syntax here for doing the application of this function on classes. And that creates a new class synced fstream that has all the functionality from fstream together with the mixed in sync RV things. So although this language never has any syntax like mixin per se, it is in the effect that it has, it actually has this mixin type of constructs in there. Yeah, and that's how you instantiate these things, then use them. So yeah, in the slides, I think you also have an example of how to dynamically add your mix into your base class. I didn't bother to add that on here, but if you're interested in that, you can look it up on the lecture slide anyway. So that's just for show that there is mix-ins out there, and you can use that. However, you have to use a language that actually allows you to do something like this, where you keep your ancestor still unmentioned and still be able to do something like call to the super version of your thing. So that maybe explains why mix-ins aren't found in something like C-sharp or Java, where you are quite restrictive in your type system. Okay? Good. So that was kind of the lesson to learn for this Ruby thing. It was not about you actively becoming Ruby programmers, but to see what you have to accept as constraints on your language in order to be able to get something like mixins. So I hope that clarified a little bit how mixins actually work. And yeah, let's maybe have a look at the next best thing in line. That is now... now that you have seen the stream wrapper implemented in Ruby, you get a feeling of how you can work with mixins to achieve certain functionalities. Now let's have a look at the same problem, but from a different perspective or with different means to program. And that would be, well, we don't have actual traits in a language that's actually comfortable to use. So the only thing that I can offer you here is this Java 8 virtual extension methods that are somehow offering a composition that comes quite close to what the trait composition is. So let's have a look at stream wrapper problem from the perspective of Java. And to shorten things up, I've given you kind of the frame, the wireframe of the environment of the streams already. Then, so there's stream. In this case, I've restricted myself to just a read-only stream. Has a signature of just read. Then there's the file stream. That is a specific stream that, or special stream that extends stream with default implementation of read. So I'm not so much interested of what it actually does, but that there is an implementation here. It will return zero in our examples later on. And the network stream is also a quite boring network. It will also return zero, but it is a different implementation and all that. And you know what it's supposed to mean. So then there's another interface that provides all the synchronization means in terms of acquiring locks. Acquiring locks in our framework will be quite easy. It will just do nothing. But once again, it's just for having an implementation there. And you can imagine that that is a lot of complicated. But we did that in the first part of the lecture and don't focus on that now. So now to get something like synchronized file stream, we now have to do a little bit of work here. So, Emix is still open, so let's close that. Yeah, you can save that, that's okay. Was it streams Java? I think so. Yeah, so that is the setting here. And now the idea would be to come up with a synchronized file stream as our new end product. We could choose to deliver now in form of a new trait that offers composed functionality, or whether we want to terminate our hierarchy here and provide a class that is the end product of what we actually want to deliver. So in our case, let's just stick to a class. And that would be something like that. Yeah, in order to obtain functionality from the traits, we somehow need to perform the trait composition, which is trait sum. And the closest thing to that would be, well, to implement from these interfaces. So file stream and is it a, yeah, it's a comma and sync like that. Fine. Good. But now we still need to somehow not only inherit or get the implementations from modules, we also need to somehow mix them in a we need to somehow come up with the actual functionality that we want to have. So in our case, that would be a read that where's the other one gone? A read that actually does something, and particularly it would call the acquire lock. That's fine. Then it would actually perform the read version, perform the read, then do the release lock and return. So that would be the idea of having or somehow using the functionality now. Well, you see a problem in that? But if you run that, you will very soon see that there's a problem. It doesn't terminate. With the reason that...
Yeah, to what read does this direct?
Yeah, and it redirects to itself. So it's a recursion. Mm-hmm. So we somehow need to resolve that. And... Stack overflow, yeah. Yeah. In principle, we need to redirect that to the read of our ancestor. So the syntax to do that in the virtual extension methods is to actually name the ancestor, put a super in there. I don't know why. Don't ask me. It's just, yeah. But that's how you redirect to your ancestor. With that, you get rid of your recursion and have a solution that maybe satisfies in the first glance. But then you ask yourself, well, when I have to explicitly mention that I take my read from the file stream...
The same for the acquire lock and the release lock.
Yeah, well, it's not... there's nothing like that conflicting within the sync file stream.
Anyway.
So that is okay, but you still have to provide the same version of read for the sync network stream and each other stream where you put your sync trait. So you have to actually rewrite this read thing for each of the versions where you actually compose with your synchronization facilities. Yeah, but there is one other thing. We don't have anything like renaming, so that we cannot really get rid of this name conflict with read here, but we have something different that we can use, and it's a kind of a separate technique. So let's maybe design a little bit more around that. Let's start with designing a wrapper for synchronization. With W, of course, not a wrapper. And it's something that extends the synchronization facilities. And in there, we try to provide the code from above.
Yeah.
The complete room is just trash, isn't it? For people at home, the projector now has died. Yeah, anyway. I'm sorry, that's the quickest solution for me now. So I hope that helps. So the idea would be now to provide a read function here in that wrapper that is kind of universally usable throughout throughout our hierarchy. So here what we would do is we would acquire lock and and release the lock, and in between what we would do is we would have to somehow read from the ancestor. The problem is we don't know the ancestor yet, and calling to just read will call will create a recursion. So what can we do? We can do the following. We can just write read inherited, inherited, like that, and return the red version, and say, well, don't know what read inherited is yet, but I can just tell in our signature of the interface that there is need for such a thing, and leave it unimplemented or abstract. So that is an open abstract signature that we still need to bind at some point. Yeah. And now I can perform something similar to the way of this aliasing and subtraction of entries in the mappings by just referring to overwriting methods. So in the sync network stream, I can say it implements the network stream and the sync wrapper, and in here I can now provide an actual implementation for the read inherited, and can make that bind to the network stream's read version. So here I can now perform a public int read inherited, which here just returns the network stream super read, like that. And since the read things are still in conflict, I need to resolve which one is the write, and I will do so by saying that the sync wrappers version is the one that I want to choose here. And be done. So it's still glue code that you have to provide here, and it's still messy and lengthy because it's Java, but I don't have to provide algorithmic input here anymore. So I don't have to rewrite my my maybe complicated logic. In our example, it's not complicated. It's just acquire and release, putting put around the calls. But here I have I only have to think about binding names to actual implementations, and with that I can just put the sync wrapper in several places, have to bind the correct versions of read and read inherited, and be done. So that is the options that I have in order to kind of simulate the approach that I have heard about with the traits. And that's the best that we get so far for a mainstream implementation of traits. That all needs a little bit of practice and getting used to, and actually exploring a little bit in the world of default methods and virtual extension methods as a concept, but it's just another option for you in order to design your code and develop software. I don't know whether it will be your concept of choice for designing APIs or libraries, but it's there to make you aware of the possibilities that you get with that kind of constructs. Yeah. Then, next one. I've put a lot of assignments on there, as this is kind of the joint version of the mixin and traits now. So it's going from one to the other to the next and all that. So, yeah. Another focus on virtual extension methods now. So to clarify a little things about that, I think is also taken from an exam at some point. So this was about virtual extension methods. There's an abstract class A with an abstract function F. This one here. There's an interface K that has a default method for G. An interface I that extends K that provides another F. And J that extends K that provides another F. And in the end, we find something that composes everything with each other. So that is a public class C that extends A and implements I and J. The question is now, we know for sure, because I said so, that this thing doesn't compile. The question is now why. Do you see any reasons why that might not compile?
Say which implementation of the method F we should now take.
Mm-hmm. So there's kind of conflicts in there because we have on the implementation level where we have these virtual extension methods, you're talking about a method F and a method F over here, both on the same level, composed symmetrically. That will probably be a conflict.
And then we even have the F from the abstract class.
Now that's the interesting point. How does that, what influence does that have on the whole thing? So first of all, you have pointed out one cause for an error, and that is exactly having these things. If you would, for example, remove the F from J, like that, you would get rid of one error in the code. Is that, if we do that, is that now correct? And you said there is still the matter of having this abstract F hanging around. Is that a compile time error? Or is that without any dangers?
Well, from my knowledge, it's like that, that you, in the abstract class, you have the signature of the method and the program is then later implemented in the actual class, which inherits from the abstract class. So now I have a compile time error in my head. Because I'm not sure how the interface, which are also inherited from.
And that's exactly the point here, which is important to look at. So you say that this abstract method F from A opens up a new abstract signature. That's correct. And it's supposed to be overwritten by other classes. The question is now, are these interfaces able to close that gap and overwrite these things? And you have to read those things as, if you implement from interfaces with these things, this is kind of the symmetric composition. That's a trait sum that's working here. Then there is this extension thing. How does that relate to the part over there? And between the class that's mentioned here and the things that are mentioned here, you have an asymmetric composition. So it is like that. And the A is gets to be the one who is dominant here. And the abstract F from A is still abstract, although you mixed although you composed your trait-like virtual extension functions into the system. So if we would have an F within K, we would be completely fine, because the I and J would have overwritten them. The, as we have an F within A, we get the problem. So in order to resolve that, we would have to provide an implementation for F where we would redirect to our beloved F from I, or F from J, if we would desire that one to be called, in order for the whole system to have an F afterwards. So ironically, just adding this overwritten version of F would get rid of all the compiler errors anyway. So that's the only change that you have to do in that code in order to make it compile. But I think that was kind of worth the discussion about that. On an implementation view of things, remember when we had the dispatching lecture and we have talked about what is actually happening in the hotspot virtual machine, where, well, at least in the virtual machines part, the runtime part of dispatching, there was several phases mentioned there how method resolution actually works. And I was kind of hand-waving over certain areas of the code there, which I didn't want to draw focus too much on. And it's exactly those places where the resolving of the virtual extension methods happen. So in this dispatching, the virtual machine first of all descends into the lists of functions that are provided from the classes and descends through the superchain. And if it is able to find a signature that is convenient for your call, and it is telling us abstract, it's not provided here, then everything is kind of terminating here. And or if it actually finds an implementation, it would just overwrite anything that would come after, because the resolution of the virtual extension methods is happening after the phase where you scan through all your class functions. So it's dominated by all the entries that you get in your class functions. And that's kind of the implementation reason why it behaves like that. And that was a lot. Yeah, well, in an implementation sense, first all the classes are searched for the right names and queried. And if there is an answer, it will always be taken, no matter how close in terms of points where you attached your virtual extension methods to your system actually were, because that's a completely separate phase that comes after. That's what I want to say with that. Okay. So, yeah, so much about virtual extension methods. I think it would be beneficial to just play around a little bit with those and get to know them in order to get a feeling of what you can actually achieve with them. But, yeah. For that, you need to hands-on code, and that's just what I cannot do so much in these time frames. But surely you would benefit from something like that. So it's already 10 to 12. Still, there's this Scala traits thing out there. That is kind of a little bit strange for me, because I'm not so familiar with the Scala world. Was it you, a little bit of a Scala guy? Okay, so you might be able to kind of lead us through that thing a little bit. It's about exploring what the expressivity of these things actually are. So it's not so much about details of knowing how Scala is actually working, but on a specific aspect of the whole thing. Especially what you find there is that there are certain entities in there that are called traits in the Scala language, but Scala still talks about something like mixins, at least as far as I know. But it's
I programmed Scala 2 years ago.
Okay.
I even don't know if there's a new version of Scala out. And
okay, so that doesn't matter too much. I think what they refer to as mixing traits in is this part here, where you have these with clauses. And the question is now, what is Scala actually offering you? Is it mixing approach or is it traits approach? Because in principle, that is a fundamental difference between them. And well, it's not so easy to actually see if you're not used to Scala programming. Thing is, if I see something like that, where I just move the sequence around in which I provide my entities, whether it might be traits or mixins, I can say whether it is the actual intention of having mixins or traits by observing whether there is a change in what is actually called when I do that. And turns out that if you do that, it actually matters whether you put bar or buzz in front of your chain of mixed in things. So it's actually mixed ins that you get here. So don't be confused with our notions of traits that we have introduced here that came from a certain paper, and finding these keyword traits in this keyword trait in a language like Scala in this case. These kinds of overloaded naming things are happening a lot in programming languages, and same things here. It's called trait, but acts like a mixin. You actually have to toy around a little bit to actually find out how it really behaves, and then you're on the right track. But be careful if you read those things. Actually try to question them and come to your own conclusions about what the expressivity of certain language features actually is. That is not meant as a criticism on Scala. I think Scala is doing a fine job. It's just about situations like that where you are presented with a kind of very obvious hint that a language feature would provide something that doesn't. So, yeah, that is kind of the thing that I wanted to hint with this exploring this the Scala traits. So if you execute that, you will actually get different behavior. That indicates that you're actually having a kind of a mix-in approach and not a trait approach. But that's maybe, do you say that, splitting hairs? Well, it's very much into details here. So, but with that, I think I want to conclude for today. I'm actually feeling quite happy that we came to the last assignment just in time. So thank you for your attention. And next time, I think on Wednesday, we'll do prototype-based programming with Lua. Then. You actually like that?
Yes.
We'll see whether you still like that word. We have to do it.